Broadcasting live from the Mobile Veritex Community Bank Studios, located at Rose Hill Beer Garden in Cypress.
Don't sweat the technique.
It's the Killer Bees.
Definitely a fan of the Killer Bees.
Now bringing you the fastest 3 hours in Houston sports radio. Here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Ooh, what up, H-Town? Hey, how we doing?
He's Blank, I'm Branham, B-Mac, our on-site engineer, A-Rod, Austin Rodriguez, back at the Gal Stations. All right, we're broadcasting live, Rose Hill Beer Garden. The boys are out there. I'm in Dallas ahead of the big game tonight. A family-friendly spot, 8 local food trucks, fantastic beers, fantastic vendors, live music every Thursday through Saturday, voted the number one music venue in Cypress, by the way. It's owned by Eddie. I think that you've met Eddie before, haven't you, Blankers?
No, not personally.
I know that you've talked about him. He's the Food Network superstar, former NFL player that went to Arkansas. I know we've talked about him. I thought you'd met him. That's my bad.
Yeah, no, Jerome knew him, and we were trying to get him on the air a few months ago about something that was on the Food Network, I believe. But, yeah, no, Jerome is the one that had the relationship with him.
There you go. I misplaced the two. But Eddie's the owner. It opened in 2018 to promote community. It's a small, chill place, safe place. Not small. It's safe and chill. It's for families. It's a great spot to hang out. So get out here. We'll be here until 6. The boys will be there until 6. But a great spot to hang out, have a drink, and enjoy all those local food trucks. Joe Espada, first day on the job, and he's already getting a lot of let's go with critiques. Because I don't know if you can necessarily hate all of the moves. We'll get into them. But a lot of questionable decisions, at least decisions that were different than we've become accustomed to. And we can go through these chronologically. I think it's the way to do it. The very first one was Framber Valdez. Pulling Framber Valdez after 4 2/3. He got himself into trouble, had the bases loaded. Pulled him an out away from a potential chance to at least leave the game as the pitcher on record, but went with Seth Martinez. As we know, the Astros would blow the 4-run lead. Let's start there. What did you make of the decision of pulling Framber after 4 2/3?
You know what? I noticed it, but I wasn't going to complain about it because Framber didn't have his A game. He didn't have his great stuff. This is the first start of the year. I'm not sure how much further he would have gone anyway. I was fine with him pulling there. I understand you want to try and get him a win on opening day. And, you know, he was battling. I don't want to say lucked out, but he got 2 ground balls to get out of 2 innings with double play balls. And I was fine. Now, who he went to was probably a little bit of a shock to me. But I was not shocked and I was not upset that he pulled Framber when he did.
Who's he going to in that spot, though?
That's a good question. I mean,
yeah, I didn't have a problem with Seth there. Like, I mean, these middle relievers are going to have to be working in these spots. Like, you're not going Presley there. You're not going Hader there.
Montero's a possibility.
Maybe. Yeah. Like, do you want Montero to be your fireman? I don't know. Like, maybe.
I don't want Montero on my baseball team, but I mean,
I don't think there's a great answer there. For the record, like maybe somebody different. Like, he didn't have Abreu yesterday. I'm not sure there's a great answer there. I didn't have a problem pulling Framber either. Like, Framber had been playing with fire the entire game. He finally got burned with that fire. It's opening day. He's at 86 pitches. You give him another hitter, all of a sudden 86 turns into the 90s. That's too much for the first start of the entire year. I didn't have any issue with that first questionable Joe Espada decision, the most interesting manager in the world. So I was good with that. I have no issue with that. How about Montero? Montero in the 6th inning, your lead by a run, facing the bottom of the order. Any objection to using Rafael Montero in that spot?
Well, let's just set the record right off the top for those that don't know. I'm not a big Montero fan. I looked at BMAC when they made the move, and I went, uh-oh, I don't like this at all. I just, you know, your rebuttal to it is probably going to be the same thing. Who would you have gone to? That is going to be the question that we continue to answer until we figure out and they figure out what they're going to do with that middle of the bullpen. But I'm never really excited. I always have a bad feeling when he comes into the game. But you're right. It was the bottom of the order. I saw that and I thought, well, if he can't do it against the bottom of their order, who can he do it against? So I get you go to a veteran guy there that you know, that your manager previously has had a lot of confidence in that's been better than average for you for the most part. So you go to him there. I don't like Montero. I don't like him there or anywhere, but I understand you're going to go to your veteran arm out of the bullpen in the middle like that when he did.
Yeah, if he's on the team, that's a spot where he's going to have to pitch. Like he's going to have to be able to pitch in the sixth inning. And you could say, well, the rosters, that's where they're weak. Yeah, that is where they're weak. The middle of their middle relief, they are weak. They're a little bit soft in the middle. I thought Montero was one pitch away from having a good outing. Like that was not a good pitch. King of Twitch was saying yesterday it was a good pitch. It was a 1-2 slider that he left in the middle part of the zone. It wasn't middle, it was middle in, but that's a back foot slider that you're trying to bury in the dirt, and he left it over the middle of the plate. That was not a good pitch. It was a mistake. You're right.
Yeah, it was just hanging there screaming, hit me, and you know what? You're right. Maybe, you know, he places that a little differently or drives it down out of the zone and you know, he gets out of the inning. But, you know, that's again, kind of the fear factor that I have with him is that no matter how good he can look from hitter to hitter, pitch to pitch, he seems to find a way to find the barrel of a bat when you need it least.
And that, I mean, that's the difference between a good reliever and just an average reliever, quite frankly, or the difference between an average reliever and a bad reliever. Like, they're in the bigs. All of them have good stuff. What makes a guy great? What makes a guy not great? Well, consistency. I thought Montero, other than that one pitch, was solid, but that one pitch is turned into a home run. He hung a 1-2 slider. Yes, it was out of the strike zone, but it was middle in, and he took advantage of it. Wasn't a good pitch. That's supposed to be in the dirt. Supposed to be on his back foot. The one that's getting the most run with these questionable Espada decisions is pinch hitting for Jake Myers in the sixth inning for John Singleton. It was a tie game at the time. You had runners at first and third with two outs. You go with John Singleton in that spot. What's going through your mind is, I know we were on the air yesterday when this happened, but then when you had some time to let it marinate and then do all the prep that you do.
I was shocked, Jeremy. I was. At the time, looking at what they needed, because they weren't looking for a big fly there. They were looking for a base hit. They needed a guy that could get a base hit. Jake wasn't Jake of last year. Jake already had a bomb for you. So if you're going to leave Jake in the game, I'm fine with it because it's still early enough. If you're not going to go to Jake, then, and especially if you're going to replace Jake in the outfield anyway with Dubon, I would have gone to Dubon there because Dubon, if he's anywhere like he was a year ago, he can get you a base hit. You need a two-out base hit there. You're not looking for the big fly. Singleton's not the guy I would have gone to. I would have gone to Dubon if I did it at all, and I would have been totally fine if he'd just stood pat and just let Jake have another at-bat.
I totally understand the logic here from Joe Espada. Like, Loaisiga was the pitcher. Loaisiga is a right-handed pitcher that's really, really tough against right-handed hitters. Sometimes you have right-handed pitchers that are pretty even, that their numbers against lefties and righties are relatively the same, so it doesn't matter a whole lot. Loaisiga is the opposite. Loaisiga dominates righties. He's not very good against – well, he's fine against lefties, but he's not as dominant as he is against righties. So I understand where Espada is coming from. I understand the logic. The problem is your left-handed batter off the bench just isn't very good. This is why I was clamoring for a left-handed bat to come off the bench, because John Singleton is not a Major League Baseball player. So I understand Espada's logic. Well, I need a lefty against that right-handed reliever because he dominates righties. He's not good against lefties. Cool. Like, John Singleton's not that guy, though. John Singleton I do not trust. So even though that Loaisiga is dominant against righties and not lefties, if you're forced to pinch hit there, which I'm not sure you are, I'm going Mauricio Dubon, despite what the numbers tell me. So, like, you can throw criticism to, like, Dana Brown for not filling out this roster with a quality left-handed bat off the bench. You could say, well, maybe keep another guy. But at the same time, Espada has to play the hand that he's dealt. And while I understand the logic, that's not the play. Singleton is not that guy.
No, he absolutely isn't. And, you know, like you, I was thoroughly amazed that he made the roster. I know he's out of options. If you let him go, he's got to go. But guess what? So what? If he goes, so be it. Good luck to you. Hope you latch on with a team where maybe you can find it and you end up being a guy that can be on a squad in Major League Baseball. You've had two opportunities here. Yeah, you've had a couple of moments. But overall, more than anything else, it's a boom or bust with a whole lot of bust. And that wasn't the situation for him regardless. I'm not big on him being on the bench, but I'm certainly not big on him in that situation.
Yeah, you gotta know your pieces. Like, I get the logic. The lefty's a better chance there than a righty, but is Singleton a better chance than Dubon, despite what the lefty-righty tells
so.
You? I don't think so either. So I am going to criticize Espada for that move. Like, I get it. I totally get the numbers. But John Singleton has shown you nothing to where he's going to get a big hit in a big spot or just get a hit, period, against Major League Baseball pitching. Presley in the seventh inning. What'd you think of that one?
I was a little surprised, But at the same time, if he felt like that was where, you know, he needed to kind of stranglehold the game and that's where he wanted to use him, you knew he wasn't going to close. So if that's where he wanted to use him, then so be it. He used him. It didn't work out. He gave up a run. It's made everybody even more critical of the move. He's supposed to be, you know, your eight-inning guy, but they've also been – there's been discussions about, you know, shuffling guys around. If that's where he wanted to use Presley at a point where you needed a shutdown inning, then I'm fine with it. I didn't have that big of a problem with him there.
I actually like it because you're using, you know, yesterday you didn't have Abreu, so he's your second best reliever. Mm-hmm. He's probably number two on the depth chart anyways. Like, they probably have Presley higher than Abreu. And he brought him in the seventh inning to face 3-4-5 because it was a higher leverage spot than the eighth inning when he would potentially be facing 6-7-8. So he brought him in to face Judge, Stanton, Rizzo instead of, you know, the bottom of that order, near the bottom of that order. So I actually like that move by Espada. It didn't work out. Hindsight 20/20 there. I actually applaud that move. I liked it. It was the progressive moves that we want from a modern manager. The question that I have off of it is, what happens when Abreu's back? Like, And they're both available. Like, is Abreu the fireman? Is Abreu the one you're using in the leverage spot and Presley's bumping to the eighth? Or are you using Presley in that big spot and then bumping Abreu to the eighth? So whenever they're at full strength, I'm really curious to see what the pecking order is. Or maybe they bring them in different windows where one guy comes in the sixth, another guy comes in the eighth. Something crazy like that.
I think it's going to be fluid. Yeah, I definitely think it's going to be fluid. You know, as analytical as they are, too, with the matchups and the numbers and the tendencies, I think that's not going to be as set in stone as Hader is as your closer. And maybe there is even a little fluctuation there. But I think as it relates to both Presley and Abreu, I think that they are going to let that be a case-by-case scenario where, depending on the situation and what the numbers and everything are telling them, they'll go accordingly that way as opposed to just saying, you got the seventh, you got the eighth.
Do you like that?
I'm fine with that, yeah. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, the obvious result that everybody's looking for is get a clean inning or get out of a jam and escape with as much of a clean inning as you can. And so if you feel like, you know, there's numbers that lean a certain way, one guy versus the other, it's not, like I said, as definitive as your closer is for a lot of teams. So I'm fine with going with the right matchup with what the numbers say, depending on the situation.
Yeah, I think it's more of the quality of the pocket of the lineup. I think it's more about, like, the pocket that you're going to face in the seventh versus the pocket in the eighth. Which one is more dangerous? Okay, this one on the left is more dangerous. Maybe it's the seventh inning, and we're going to use our best guy against that better pocket. I actually love it. I like it a lot. The question I would have is, will Abreu and Presley – and we've seen Abreu do it more because he's bounced around more, you know, 6th, 7th, 8th inning, whatever. Will Presley be able to adapt to pitching the 7th inning one night, the 8th inning the next night? I think he will. Like, he used to do it before he was a closer. So I don't really think it's going to be something that is a long-term issue, but it will be something that I'm monitoring. Final one's Hader in the 9th, down by a run. What did you think about that one?
I didn't like it. If your closer is truly your closer, then I'm only using my closer in safe situations or situations where I'm trying to keep a game tied going into the bottom of the last inning. When you're down a run in the 9th inning, I don't know if it's going to change. BMAC and I were talking about this off the air a couple of times. I don't know if now he's going to change his philosophy or he and his agent's philosophy that he's going to be more open to pitching 2 days in a row and or one or two innings instead of just one inning situations now that he got the big contract and that was kind of one of his objectives. But if you don't have a safe situation there for a guy that has had his they were monitoring, you know, how often he pitches and things like that, I wouldn't have used him there. I would have found somebody else and then taken your best shot in the bottom of the 9th, and I wouldn't have burned my closer in game one down a run.
Yeah, I haven't heard too much of him not being open to pitching on back-to-back days. Now, the more than an inning is something that is big and something that has, you know, been clouding him for a couple of years now. I don't think that will change unless you get to the postseason. I thought it was a little interesting because you don't have Abreu again today. So, like, is Presley up today? Is Hader up today? I feel like he managed that like it was a playoff game yesterday. I'm not sure that we would – I have a hunch that Espada's not going to normally do that. But because it was opening day, like, use all of your toys for opening day, I don't think that'll be something that we see going forward. But who knows? It'll be something that we keep an eye on.
here's the thing, Jeremy. I'm with you because you don't have Abreu today, but Presley threw a lot of pitches. I could see a situation where Hader could come back today, but I'm not expecting Presley to be available this early in the season, having thrown a decent amount of pitches. I don't think that they're going to go to Presley today.
No, I think Presley's down. I think Hader has a chance. He only threw 13 pitches, but I agree with you on Presley. Like, I don't see any chance that Presley pitches today. Hader, maybe. Okay, one more. It's not really Espada, but kind of Espada, because Espada had this whole philosophy during spring training where they want to be aggressive philosophy on the bases. And I'm like, uh-oh, I don't love that. I don't like running into outs on the bases because you only get 27 outs. Those are precious. I don't want to use those outs by being thrown out on the bases. Game one, we see it, the Gary Pettis send, watching all the replays, hearing all the sound bites afterwards. Hindsight 2020. How'd you like that aggressive send by the windmill?
I didn't like it at all. I think you got to know, as you're with Pettis, how everybody knows the strength of the arms in the outfield, and Soto's got a cannon. He's got a good arm. You would set up a situation where first and third, one out with Bregman at the plate, you've got a guy that has a good eye at the plate that, because people are saying, well, the end result would have been the same because he didn't do a double play. But when you think about it, if it's situational. If Bregman knows all I need is a fly ball to tie the game, I think that his approach at the plate probably changes a little bit. He puts a little bit more lift on his swing. I think you got a better chance to get a fly ball to get that run in. But I don't want to run into the third out. Instead of having first and third, one out, and having a good hitter at the plate, I just wouldn't have sent him there.
Yeah, I'm with you. You said third out, you meant second, but I knew what you meant.
Second, yeah.
I also heard everybody talk about, it was a perfect play, but it took a perfect play. No, it didn't. Like, Soto was in shallow right field. Soto has a good arm, but not like a cannon. He also one-hopped it, and it was 5 feet up the third base line. Like, that was not a perfect play. That was not a perfect throw. And I heard this narrative after that, it took a perfect play to get Dubon. No, it didn't. It wasn't a great throw. It was from shallow right, and it was up the third base line. It took an average at best play for Dubon to be thrown out. So I hated it. I don't like it at all. I know a lot of people are pointing to this philosophy where Espada wants to be aggressive and take extra bases. I'm not a huge fan of that. I think you should take the bases you can get. Be aggressive, but don't be dumb. And I felt yesterday was a bit dumb. Bases loaded, one out. You got your cleanup man coming to the plate. You got to have faith in Bregman there. I didn't like that at all. Not a fan whatsoever.
Especially charging inward, right? Maybe, maybe I spoke a little too much, too great of his arm. But, I mean, he's an above-average arm in the outfield, charging full steam ahead on a ball where it was a pretty clean ball to field. I don't think you want to get the second out at home plate instead of leading Bregman, one of your best four hitters, at the plate with first and third and one out.
That's a great point. Like, any lateral movement, cool. He's coming straight in. He's in shallow right. He one-hopped. It wasn't even a perfect throw. I hated it. 713-780-3776. What did you think of these questionable spotted decisions? Also, Framber Valdez, his final line was not very good. I do have some optimism, though, when it comes to Framber Valdez yesterday. It's the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
ESPN 97. Broadcasting live from the Mobile Veritex Community Bank Studios, located at Rose Hill Beer Garden in Cypress. Here are the Killer Bees, Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
713-780-ESPN, HRMP listener line, 713-780-3776. We're on the Twitch, twitch.tv/ESPN97.5, on YouTube at ESPN Houston, at Pac-Man Joel on Twitter, at Sack by BMAC, at Jeremy Branham. We are on remote at Rose Hill Beer Garden. Family friendly. There's 8 local food trucks, so you can get a lot of really good food along with your a really good drink. Live music every Thursday through Saturday. Craft vendors. Fantastic spot. It's safe. Chill place for families. Get on out here to Rose Hill Beer Garden today. If you can't, see you here this weekend. 713-780-3776. So I have some optimism from Framber Valdez. And look, let's be very, very clear. I'm not happy with the line. I'm not happy with 3 runs, 5 hits, 6 walks, 5 strikeouts. Anytime you give up 3 runs and 4 2/3, it is not a good start. Anytime you walk 6 hitters, it is not a good start. Here's the optimism that I have, though, from Framber. The sinker was working. He was getting ground balls. We think Fromber's a better pitcher when he's getting those ground balls. and he did not give up hard contact at all. So it's not like the Yankees were sitting there teeing off on him. In fact, the Yankees as a team had two extra base hits yesterday, the Judge double against Ryan Pressly, and then the home run off of Rafael Montero. Fromber, even the five hits he was giving up, soft contact, he was getting the ground balls, he got swing and miss, five strikeouts and 4 2/3. There were some things that I liked from Fromber's start yesterday, it's just the six walks is way too many.
Yeah, absolutely, Jeremy. And if this is a start in the middle of June, we've got a lot more to talk about. This is first start of the year. I liked, for the most part, his location. I still think, obviously, there's going to be a lot of guys that are a tick off. They're not, you know, they're not completely stretched out, or you're not going to, you know, feel strongly about them going into, like, even, you know, the mid-70s, you know, or higher pitch count-wise. I know he was dabbling around the 70s when things started to go wrong. It's just that when you look at it, it's opening day, it's the Yankees, people put a lot more weight on it. But I'm kind of with you. I thought the location was down where it needed to be more times than not. I thought that he was just a tick off in terms of his location overall, in terms of the walks and the control. But he was dodging too many bullets to where I didn't think he was going to go too much longer. But I'm not losing any sleep over the fact that Framber Valdez, you know, didn't get a win on the opener and you know, didn't get out of the fifth inning. I believe that he's going to continue to progress, and I liked at least where a lot of the location was. I thought he got squeezed a little bit on some pitches, too. There was a Rizzo at-bat where he painted the bottom of the zone a couple of times, didn't get a call. But you also saw that when he didn't get a call, he didn't hide his feelings on a majority. And there were several calls that he was displeased with, and he showed it, and that's what worries you more than anything, because he's got to keep his psyche in order.
It's difficult for me to say location when you walk six guys, though. Like, when you're walking six guys, your location's not very good. I thought he had trouble with the location. I thought he had trouble with the command. But I think his stuff was good, that it was a lot of soft contact and bunch of ground balls. Like, that's when Fromber is good. Fromber is good when he's getting ground balls. The walks is just way too many. Any other silver linings from the game that you saw yesterday? 713-780-3776. What about you, Blankers?
I liked a couple. I liked Pena at the plate. I thought Pena looked like a guy that obviously, again, it's just a small sample size, but it looked like he was in control at the plate. He looked like he was putting good barrel to the ball. Obviously, you got to be happy with Chaz and Yiner. And the bottom of the lineup, to me, when you throw in the home run by Myers too, bottom of the lineup was very impressive. It was good to see. The top half, I'm not going to worry about. They weren't, you know, obviously they weren't at their best. But for the most part, I would say for the positives, Pena and Yiner for me for sure. And, of course, I have to mention the positive of a Jake Myers home run when I didn't expect that.
Myers was the tell of two tells. The first at-bat hits a 400-something foot home run with like an exit velo of 110 or whatever it was. And then the second one he struck out. And then he got pinch hit for. What about you, Brian? Any silver linings? It's only one of 162. You don't love losing game one. You don't love blowing a 4-0 lead. But what silver linings did you see from yesterday's game?
I think there were several linings. I mean, we've mentioned some of them, but Chaz McCormick and Yonder Diaz both picked up right where they left off. Yonder Diaz had three hits. He mentioned Jeremy Pena with the multi-hit game. The first one he smoked and looked like it was going to be a single, but he legged it into a double, so that was very encouraging. And then the guy we mentioned in the first segment, Josh Hader, come in as advertised, worth every penny, three up, three down, three strikeouts, see you later. It just absolutely looks like he could be as dominant as advertised.
Yeah, he looked really good. Little strikeout, three guys and 13 pitches, whatever it was. He looked fantastic. That Pena double, boy, that ball was stung. I thought Pena looked good at the plate.
He smashed that ball.
Barreled it up, looked really good. And then Yiner with a three-hit game. And Yiner didn't have a great spring training either. Like, Yiner's spring training numbers, not that we should ever react to spring training numbers, to have three hits on opening day kind of alleviates any sort of concern if you were overreacting to spring training numbers, which you should never be. 713-780-3776, 6941, Valdez, way too many uncompetitive pitches. And I think that kind of goes to what you were saying, Blankers, that sometimes the mental game isn't there, which is a major concern for Fromber Valdez. Like, you got to be – his stuff is so freaking good. You got to be dialed in. Like, if you're dialed in with that sort of stuff, it eliminates the uncompetitive pitches. Yes, his control is not like a 10. His control is not fantastic. But sometimes he just kind of gets a little bit lazy, kind of relies on his stuff, and then all of a sudden it's a 3-1 count. Now you're in danger.
Here's where I stir up Astros fans.
Uh-oh.
Let's hear it.
You need a guy like Maldi right there to come out and make sure that when he looks like he's getting a little shaky between the ears, Maldi comes out and settles him down and calms everything down and sets the situation. Yiner maybe isn't there yet. Maybe by midseason we see him doing those kind of things. Someone's got to – to me, you can read his body language and his facial expressions that he still has – no matter who he's working with and what he's doing, he still lets little things like one pitch and one at-bat really get to him. And that's something that's gonna haunt him until he finally figures a way to be able to be good with just moving forward.
Yeah, I think you're overreacting to that. Like, where was Maldi in the second half of last season when he was atrocious?
I was kidding, obviously.
I couldn't tell. I couldn't. Oh
no, there was.
I'm
learning
from
you.
Okay.
There's a lot of people out there on Twitter that already started playing that Maldi card again about, is Yiner going to be able to do this? I mean, this, and I'm like, come on, man. It's one game, and it's the most volatile mental pitcher mentally that you have on your staff.
Yeah, he is mentally volatile. That is 100% true. 713-780-ESPN, the HRMP listener line, 713-780-3776. Your optimism, your silver linings, what'd you think of those spotted decisions? Also, we're going to will a bit something whenever we come back. You never know what you're going to get. Which will a bit are you getting today? 713-780-3776. It's the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
It's the Killer Bees, and I honestly have no idea what's happening next. Could it be the next great big food debate? The biggest Joel rant of all time? Jeremy trolling someone to the point of crying? Or just some actual bees making some honey? Well, let's find out. It's time for the Wheel of Bits.
Oh, my goodness, would you look at this. What an enormous bit.
It's time for Buzzkill Branham.
What an enormous spin. We're going to need a rant here from Blankers soon.
I know it.
I love me a good Blankers rant. We need you to brew one up here soon. Buzzkill Branham. Astros lineup is out real quick, by the way, same as yesterday. Carlos Rodon is on the mound for the Yankees, so they're going with their left-handed lineup for the Stros. Altuve, Yordan, Tucker, Bregman, Abreu. He wasn't great yesterday. Chaz, Yiner, Pena, and Meyer. So the same as yesterday. All right, here's what I'm buzzkilling today, Blankers. I love the story from Renel Blanco. You know, kind of a guy who is taking a little while to get to the bigs. He's going to be this year. He is 30 years old. He's going to turn 31 years old this summer in August. You know, it took him a while to make his debut in 2022. We know the story where Dana Brown's like, oh, I kind of like this guy extended out. Maybe we can make him a fringe starter for this team. He had the baby the other day whenever they had the exhibition game, and he pitched really well. He had double-digit strikeouts in 4 1/3, 10 Ks in 4 1/3, allowed just one run. Espada went out and pulled him from the game and said, hey, by the way, you made the club. He's going to start game 4, game 5. They haven't announced yet. Fantastic. Like, this, that's a great story. I think Blanco is going to be pretty good for the Astros, too. Like, I like his stuff. Don't ever think he's going to be a top half of the rotation guy. I think he's going to be like a 4 or 5 or a long reliever in the bullpen. So I like the story. Like, it's great. I like that he's on the team. A couple of things I'm buzzkilling here. The first one's the injuries with the Astros. If they were at full health, Renel Blanco is not touching this pitching staff.
Now
he's your 4 or your 5. He's behind Jose Urquidy. He's behind Justin Verlander. He's behind Luis Garcia. And he's behind Lance McCullers. So let's keep that in mind when we're talking about Renel Blanco. But then you see some tweets of like, give a lot of praise to Dana Brown, who saw the ability as Renel Blanco as this potential starter. Okay, let's look at Renel Blanco as a starter in Major League Baseball. Last year was his first ever year where he pitched as a starter in Major League Baseball. In 7 starts, he gave up 20 runs in 38 innings. He had a 4.74 ERA in those 7 starts. Cool story, rooting for him. I think he'll be better than those numbers. But let's not act like Dana Brown discovered this Cy Young and turned him from a reliever to a starter. He saw a guy that's a fringe major leaguer that might have the stuff to go 4 or 5 innings. The Astros were depleted with starting pitcher depth. And like, okay, you're going to be the guy that we kind of convert into a starter. But this whole like, oh, Dana Brown's a genius because he saw something in Blanco that no one saw and he's converted this guy into an all-star starter. That's not the case, guys. Come on, let's pump the brakes a little bit when we're talking about expectations for players.
You and I talked about this last year when they were going back and forth with Belak and Blanco and trying to figure out who was the best option between the two. You're better than Belak. Okay, thumbs up. we kind of came to that deductive reasoning because of the fact that his stuff was better. Fastball was a little faster. He had more. He had closer to major league stuff. But your first point is the biggest and best one, and that is that if you're healthy with your pitchers, the only way that he's even smelling a spot on this team is if he's not stretched out and they're looking for him to be a one-inning guy in the middle of your bullpen because he has some decent stuff, because he's got a fastball that could probably translate to getting major league hitters out. But if he's better than Belak, that's one thing. If you're telling me that this is a diamond in the rough find that Dana decided to just kind of buff up and polish and get ready, and now he's going to take Major League Baseball by storm, he ain't the next, in my opinion, he's not the next J.P. France story.
I think he could be similar to J.P. France. But even J.P. France, we're talking about a back-of-the-rotation guy. Like, we're not expecting either one of those guys to turn into All-Stars. We're not expecting either one of those guys to turn into, like, Cy Young candidates. Now, I would say that Blanco's, like, best-case scenario is what we saw from J.P. France, like, in the first half of his starts last
year.
And this isn't a criticism to Blanco, because he would be on this team, even if you're healthy, because this bullpen could certainly use a guy like Ronel Blanco. Whether it's a three-out guy in the middle of a game, or it's a two-inning guy that can kind of eat some innings to save some of your better arms, Blanco would be on this squad. And yes, he had a tremendous spring. This isn't to poo-poo Ronel Blanco. Like, I know I'm buzzkill Branhaming this, but it's not buzzkilling Ronel Blanco, because I do think he has a spot on this team. He has a place on this roster to help you out the entire regular season. Right now, it's in the rotation because of injuries. Whenever you get to full health, it's probably in the bullpen in some role or some variety. I'm not buzzkilling Blanco, because I'm excited to see Blanco. I'm excited for this opportunity for him to start a few games to see what that looks like. I think he's going to help. He's one of your better 13 pitchers in this organization, so he's going to be on the roster. What I'm buzzkilling is this, like, Dana Brown is this savant that saw something in this kid that no one saw, and he's turned this guy into a top half of the rotation guy. It's not that. Like, it's cool that he stretched him out, but he did that out of kind of desperation and necessity last year. And Blanco was a very, very, very mediocre starter last season. Maybe he can go from being mediocre to being, like, on France's level, but let's call it what it is. Let's not over-exaggerate this Dana Brown find.
No, I'm with you on that. Look, I think that he's got an arm that is capable of getting major league hitters out. The reason why I don't think he's J.P. France is because enough of the league has seen him. J.P. France kind of caught the league by storm. You know, he was red hot. He was exactly what the doctor ordered a year ago. I think guys are starting to figure out J.P. France because he doesn't have that really overly dominant pitch or pitches in his repertoire, in my opinion. But I think that Blanco has an above-average fastball. I think Blanco has some stuff that can get some guys out. You're absolutely right. If it's one inning or two, because he's coming from a starter to going to a reliever, I think he would. But if you're healthy, he makes that middle of your rotation in the bullpen better. Your middle guys, because he has versatility. But I like his stuff in short doses for a team as good as the Astros are.
Yeah, I think for like. I like him as a two-inning guy at most, but I think he can be a really quality one-inning guy as well. I'm with you on that. 713-780-ESPN, HRMP listener line, 713-780-3776. 6941, let's look at the pitching situation we're in right now. Number one's a head case from last year. Number two, terrible last year. 3, 4, 5, 6 rookies. Nah, kind of. I think that it's going to be better than people think. Brian, you have a thought on Blanco?
Yeah, I think the interesting thing looking forward with Blanco, because I'm agreeing with you guys that he's a back end of the rotation guy. He's not going to be someone that comes in and takes over a spot that we don't expect him to take over. But the Astros obviously have a lot of question marks that they're hoping to get answered favorably over the second half of the season with the return of Lance McCullers Jr., with the return of Luis Garcia, hopefully the return of Justin Verlander, before May, obviously even Jose Urquidy as well. So there's a lot of question marks there. I guess my question, the way to kind of move this question forward, would be, do we see Ronel Blanco as someone, if they don't get the positive returns on McCullers, on Luis Garcia, on Urquidy, probably leave Verlander out of that conversation. I don't have any fear about him coming back. Are we comfortable with Blanco being the five throughout the season, or is that a spot where they have to make a move to improve?
Look, I think we all know that they're going to go four deep max in the playoffs anyway, but I think that that's what it takes to get you through. I think what it comes down to is Dana Brown and is Jim Crane willing to make a move where maybe they have to take on some salary if the scenario you paint it comes to fruition. to go get another arm elsewhere. And if they're not and they're dead set on just handling this internally, then he's your fifth starter. Then, yeah, I'm fine with – I don't want Bielak. I don't want Bielak anywhere near being a starter for this team anymore. I just don't. But I believe that, again, he's a guy that can give you some quality innings. He can get some guys out. You got a team that should score some runs too, but I believe that, yeah, I'm fine with him being my five starter.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on performance, but if we're going like on what we expect him to be, I think you're fine with Blanco as your mm-hmm. five starter. Like, even if he pitched to where he pitched last year, like he has a 4.5 ERA, like, you know, that's about what a fifth starter is going to get you anyways. Now, you need your other four to be pretty good. You need your offense to be good because that five starter is not necessarily going to win you any sort of games. He's just kind of keeping you in those games. I think you can survive with Blanco as your number five. Yeah, I think that that would be okay. Now, if he's pitching and he has an ERA north of five, then I'm going to change my answer.
Yeah, then he's out there. I think the question, because there's more than one need on this team. We spent the first segment talking about how they need improvement with their middle relief. We also spent time in the first segment talking about, God, John Singleton doesn't need to be on this roster. We need a left-handed bat off the bench. If those are two things you want to get solved at the trade deadline, the Astros don't have the sort of farm system that can accomplish getting middle relief and a left-handed bat and a fifth starter. So if Blanco is someone you feel comfortable with, it's just nice to have that thing checked off in case you don't get positive answers on Urquidy, Lance McCullers Jr., and Luis Garcia.
Yeah, I would agree with that. 713-780-ESPN, HRMP listener line. Let's just not give all this praise to Dana Brown, because Ronel Blanco, at best, is a number five starter. 713-780-3776. March Madness had some fun games yesterday. What do we think of those? And we got a big one tonight. Killer Bees broadcasting live from Rose Hill Beer Garden in Cyprus on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
You're listening to the Killer Bees broadcasting from the Mobile Veritex Community Bank Studios located at Rose Hill Beer Garden in Cyprus. Here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
He's Blank, I'm Branham. We are indeed, the boys are indeed, at Rose Hill Beer Garden. Fantastic drinks, as you might imagine, it's in the name. Great food as well, family-friendly. Eight local food trucks. You can get some pizza, you can get some burgers, you can get some wings while you're out there, a little shaved ice. Crawfish, love me some crawfish. Number one music venue in Cyprus as well. Local craft vendors out there. Just a great time. It's a great spot, awesome spot. Get out to Rose Hill Beer Garden. Boys will be there until 6. Can't make it today. Get out there as soon as you can. 713-780-ESP. We'll get to March Madness in a second. We had a texter here say, could a Greg Maddux-type pitcher be as successful as Maddux was in today's game? What do you think, Blinkers?
My quick answer is depends on the umpiring. I think so. I mean, look, he painted a lot of corners. You know, obviously people talk about the fact that he got the benefit of the doubt on the edges, but he was a master of his craft. He was an unbelievable fielder, too, on top of that. But he had command of every single pitch he threw. I just think that he just got hitters out. He just had a way of getting guys off balance. And the pinpoint control is obviously what gets most guys out in this league and keeping them off balance. I think he would.
Yeah, I think he would dominate. I wish we saw more of those type of guys that were just – I mean, we forget that Greg Maddux, first half of his career, had nasty stuff. Like, he everything moved a ton, and he had pretty good velo. And then in the second half of his career, when it started – his stuff started to fade, he was a surgeon on the mound. Yep. I think he would have no problem, especially with these over-swingers nowadays. Like, these guys that swing hard, he would have them
– no question.
He would have them, like, moving in circles. It would be fun to watch. 713-780-ESPN. Four games yesterday. You had the early ones. You saw some teams advance. UConn was fantastic, just steamrolled San Diego State. I'm not sure if UConn's really been tested in this tournament after Dan Hurley says they got a raw deal. I don't know. Like, that side of the region, Blankers, has kind of opened up for them.
Well, you know, the other thing, too, Jeremy, is the fact that Hurley's sitting there with the whole, here's some cheese, we need some cheese with this wine.
Yeah.
He kept whining about, the three of the final four teams from last year on the same bracket. But the other two besides you aren't nearly the team they were a year ago.
You didn't play one. So, you didn't even play one.
Yeah, and everything has fallen your way so far. So, you know, stop whining before the tournament even starts happening, before you see how it all plays out. Because right now it looks like they've had a cakewalk to this point.
They are really good, though.
Oh, they're talented.
They are
really,
really good.
Loaded.
Don't get it twisted.
Yeah, I since November, I've been saying that whether they win it or not and go back-to-back, that is top to bottom the most talented team in the country, in my opinion.
The Clemson-Arizona game was fun. Arizona's had some tournament failures. They've been beaten by a lesser seed. I can't remember, was it 4 years in a row or something like that? This one stunned me. I saw Clemson whenever we were there last week, and where were we last week? I totally forgot where we were. Oh, Kansas City. Memphis. Memphis. We were in Kansas City for the Big 12 tournament. They all run together. We were in Memphis. Good call. They were the other games there, and I saw Clemson versus Baylor. And Clemson, you know what makes Clemson good? They make the other team not play as well. That's because of their defense, and then they don't beat themselves. They don't make mistakes. If you watch Clemson play, you wouldn't be like, that's one of the best eight teams in the country. But they're so disciplined, they're well coached, they don't make mistakes, and that's how you're able to pull off a big win against a team that's seeded better than you in Arizona.
Their front line looks like the rotation of front line guys look like they'd be a better grunge band than they would be guys that are going to go clean the glass and put baskets in down on the low post.
Hold on, what does that mean?
They got one dude that looks like he should be teaching fourth grade math.
He's not out there wearing flannel with holes in his jeans.
Their best player looks like he could be playing the drums or the bass in some kind of band like that.
You say their front court looks like a bunch of Eddie Vedders out there?
A little bit.
Okay.
A little bit.
All right.
And, you know, maybe they could sing too. I don't know.
Who was
I know that
ball?
Lance?
I can't
remember. Lance got them mixed up. What's their best player? The best player is
here, whatever. Their best player is guard, I think. But their post player is the one that gets a lot of the love, where he's the one that like gets the most out of his medium jersey. They said on the broadcast.
Yeah, with the initial, they kept showing his parents in the stands all the time. But then the guy the fan favorite is the guy that comes off the bench. It looks like, yeah. And Lance like, yeah, their best player looked like he had, you know, long curly hair. I go, that's the guy coming off the bench. That's why they all look interchangeable.
Looks like Chris Cornell.
Yeah, but they're very, very good. I mean, they just, I think you said it, Jim, they don't shoot themselves in the foot. They don't hurt themselves. They're well coached. They did what they had to do. I thought Arizona was as talented as anybody in the country, too. I had them going a long way in my bracket because I felt like that they had what everybody needed. If you needed athleticism, size, the guard. I thought that they had a really good squad, and I was shocked that Clemson came out with that win.
I mean, they beat Arizona. They beat Baylor, who's got two first-rounders. Like, they just don't make mistakes. That chef guy looks like to me, he looks like that character on Animal House. Kind of like little pudgy, little curly hair. That's,
Bluto?
That's the,
no. Was it,
I don't remember
his Belushi's nickname was Bluto or whatever?
I think so. Something I think like, that is the guy I'm talking about.
You talking about John Belushi's character, though?
Look at
me.
So.
I'm a zit.
I don't remember his name. Yeah, they look similar to me. Like, he's a taller version of that, of course. Alabama outlasting North Carolina. Fun game. Really fun game. Both of these teams played a really high tempo. Kind of got slowed down a bit in the second half. I think Alabama wanted to make it a little bit more defensive-minded. Grant Nelson was terrific. Missed those two free throws, but then was able to get his finger on that heave that would have won it. Little, you know, 75-foot shot heave after he missed those two free throws. But the Crimson Tide rolling on to the Elite Eight. I think their first time in 20 years, if I read that stat right.
Well, it's only their second Elite Eight ever, and then the last one they said on the broadcast was 2004.
Yeah, so 20 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was watching that game, and I literally turned it off thinking Carolina was taking control in the second half. I think they went up like 6 or 7 at one point. And I thought, oh, here's where Carolina puts the pedal down, and they'll put them away. And then going back and watching some of it this morning, I'm like, man, Alabama may be a better overall team than they were when they had Miller. Like, they just, you know what, they seem like that they've got athletes all over the floor, but they've got some bigs that are active, and they're dangerous, you know? I mean, as they get deeper, I think, you know, we had an Alabama fan that's a pretty loyal listener, steady listener to us that was sitting there going, yeah, Alabama's got no chance. I don't think their coach is that good, and I just don't think they got talent. You watched that team last night.
They've got players, man. Estrada and Sears, and obviously you mentioned Grant Nelson, man. They like you said, they have great athletes. They're pushing the ball constantly, tons of shooters. They have a lot of options for, you know, as far as bigs. With size to just throw, you know, bodies at you constantly. I think this might be a team that we look back when the tournament's over that was vastly underrated.
Yeah, I don't think they're as talented as they were last year, Blankers, to your point.
Right.
I think what really hurt them last year was the distraction, though. Like, and they were able to kind of kick that can down the road as far as it would go. But to me, they were just a team that was exhausted by the end of it because of the distraction.
You're right. And I think that I was curious your thoughts on Nate Oates, because I've always thought Nate Oates was a good coach.
I think he's a great coach.
I always thought he was a really good coach, and this is exactly what proves it. Like, you lose your best player. You lose a lottery pick, top five player in the NBA, and you may be a better team. The way you play, the way you you know, get things done, the way you kind of dig in when you need to. I've always been a fan of Nate Oates, and I thought he did a hell of a job.
Iowa State, Illinois was the other game in that second session. You had the best offense in the country going up against the best defense in the country. It was a tight game. I didn't love that they got Castle as one of the officials who officiated the A&M Houston game. I don't think he really knows some Big 12 basketball. But the best offense prevailing over the best defense. And what was a tight game after Iowa State, I didn't think played a good first half, got back into it. They're always right there at the end, but couldn't quite get over the hump. And Illinois advancing to take on UConn. That was a fun game with two very contrasting styles.
It just felt like, because you knew, like you set up, you knew the strength of each team, and you were going to see which team's strength prevailed. But Iowa State just never felt like they ever were comfortable, like they were ever in
their
element.
Yes,
they just never felt like they could get going. And guys that have kind of stepped up for them all season long just didn't seem like that they had the same comfortable level of offensive play that you were used to. Maybe that's credit to Illinois. But on the other side of the basketball, you know Illinois can score, and they did just that. They got a lottery pick that, or a high
Shannon.
First, that played his tail off.
A little controversy surrounding him.
Yeah, for sure.
I didn't think Iowa State played nearly as good as they're capable of in the first half and built too big of a hole. I thought they played a lot more Iowa State basketball in the second half. Because I thought they were the better team in the second half, but Illinois built up that lead, and they made some bigger plays down the stretch and able to come away with a victory. What do you guys want to know about Houston Duke?
I want to know a lot. I want to know your feelings on your keys, but just to me it just seems like Filipowski's got that kind of skill set that you don't want to get in foul trouble with him, because we know that, you know, that with the injuries, you don't want foul trouble with your front line because of the depth. Is there a concern because he can also face the basket because he likes to shoot the three, and that he could be the problem if U of H struggles with Duke's offense?
Yeah, if you're looking at Filipowski from like his offensive point of view, he's unique. He's I've heard some comparisons with Dickinson a little bit. I think Filipowski's far more athletic and is a better shooter. He might not be as large, but I think he's a better shooter, and I think he's better. Like he's capable of facing up and beating you off the dribble a little bit too. So he's a very unique 7-footer to where he can shoot the three, beat you off the dribble. Houston's probably going to double team him. I imagine they'll do their monster double. But because he can play on the perimeter and face up on you, you kind of have to time it just right, because you're not going to double-team him if he's camped out outside the three-point line. So that's going to be interesting. The communication's going to have to be good on when they send that big man to double him, because they'll double him if he gets it in the post. But then the other key is whenever they do double him, does he feel the pressure? Does he turn it over? Does he panic? Or is he cool, calm, collected, make a good pass, lead to an open shot? And then Duke's such a good three-point shooting team. 38% as a team. They're three guard. They don't have a very deep bench, which is kind of interesting because neither does Houston. I don't expect a ton of points in this game because they're both not very high-paced teams. They both have very slow tempos. But you look at their point guard, Roach, 44% three-point shooter. Yep. Tyrese Proctor, 37%. Jared McCain, who had those 8 three-pointers in the win against James Madison, which was a Duke record, he's a 42% three-point shooter. So defending Filipowski, especially in the post, putting pressure on him, trying to make it to where he doesn't make those clean passes, and then defending the three-pointers, maybe chasing him off the three-point line, because they're an elite shooting basketball team, especially with those three guards. Off the bench, maybe not as good, but Roach, Proctor, McCain are deadly.
I want you to talk a little bit, too, about the Cougs' offense and what are the keys there. But the big thing for me, the question I had for you on that is, if you're dealing with doubling Filipowski, but you obviously have to be very concerned with their outside shooting. If you had to pick one over the other, do you just trust like Roberts and others to try and go one-on-one guarding Filipowski just so that you don't get beat consistently by the three?
I think if they get burned early, they might adjust to that, but they won't start off that way, in my opinion, just because they're gonna play their philosophy, and their philosophy is to double the big. Now, one area that you can really have success with that is if you pressure the passer, and it doesn't necessarily have to lead to turnovers. Like, it leads to a pass being a little bit behind a shooter where it's not catch and shoot. He's got to take a step to his left just to make the clean catch to prevent a turnover, which is a split second away from a closeout defender. So trying to get Filipowski to be a little errant with his throws or his passes, I think, will be key. Offensively, I'm kind of curious because I think Houston and Duke are very similar but different, in which I think, Duke is one of the best offensive teams in the country, and I think they're underrated defensively. Houston's one of the best defensive teams in the country, and I think they're underrated offensively. So I think they're very similar on that front. I wonder how much they try to get Jamal Shedd in space, allow Duke to try to guard him just one-on-one, and then let Shedd either try to blow by and then make the right play. I think that's something that we could see pretty soon, because I think that Shedd has an advantage with his speed. But I also expect them to go into Juwan Roberts early and try to see if you can get Filipowski. Not that Filipowski's going to be guarding him, but to see if you can get one of their bigs into foul trouble and make them go to their short bench. So I expect to see some of that.
It would be nice to see, you know, Sharp keep going the way he was going, because he was fantastic shooting the basketball early on, especially, but he shot the ball well last game. It would be nice to see Cryer get going early, get those two guys going from the outside, make them have to adjust and really have to worry about anybody on the perimeter for U of H.
Yeah, that would be really nice. You get one of those guys to just catch fire to where they have 6-7 three-pointer game. That would go a long way. But it's a really good matchup. I was looking at the KenPom earlier of these two teams. And I was also looking at some people like ranking the best team, the best games in the Sweet 16. I think it's Houston-Duke. Houston's number two KenPom team in the country. Duke's number five. Like, this is a top five matchup in the Sweet 16, which, you know, you don't get a whole lot of that. So I think it's going to be a dogfight. I think it's going to be a really fun game. Hopefully it's a lot of fun in American Airlines. Hopefully it's painted red. I've heard that a lot of fans are traveling. So try to turn that into a home game. That would be awesome.
Yeah, they definitely need to. Look, I think it's the sexiest matchup of the night. To me, the key is just, you know, if you can neutralize Filipowski, I think their defense, the way they rotate, the way they can rotate on the perimeter, the way guys understand, how, you know, sliding out to the weak side and the next man, I feel like they can get a hand up on the three ball. I've said all along, I think Filipowski's the key. If they can, maybe to your point, if they double him a lot, but if they can just make him uncomfortable to where he's not beating you, and if you're lucky enough to get him in foul trouble, that's a bonus. But if you can just find a way to neutralize him, I like U of H's guards over Duke's guards. I think U of H's defense, clearly with rotations, will stand out, and I think that would give them the advantage they need.
Ocho, Duke is the more talented and skilled team by far. The question is how well they react to the initial shock from Houston's pressure and physicality defensively. I would say that that's an accurate like expectation of the game, because a lot of times the Cougar defense will punch a team in the face and it's like, oh boy, you're kind of on your heels early. So like first 5 minutes to me are critical key. I don't have too much of a bone to pick with him saying that. Like Filipowski's a first round pick. Jared McCain's a first round pick. I think they are about as good, talented, and skilled offensively. I have no problem saying that.
I don't think by far. I think that, you know, I think a lot of people have underestimated Shedd the same way Sasser was a year ago, where, you know, he might not be a first-round pick, or he'll be maybe a late first-round pick, but he just brings every intangible and defense and toughness and a lot of things that's going to translate on the next level. I think you've got guys that can shoot it really well of the three guys with U of H. I can give them a nod because it's Duke, because they get the opportunity to get just about every five-star in the country. But I don't think that the difference is that great.
I heard it the other way. I meant like opponents that the Cougars could face along the way. I kind of eliminated Houston from that. But yeah, maybe I read it wrong. 713-780-ESPN HRMP listener line 713-780-3776. It's not the only Sweet 16 in college basketball. It's also the Sweet 16 in the Killer Bees bracket, Killer Bees tournament. We had a couple advance to the Elite Eight yesterday, and we have a couple more Sweet 16 matchups today as two more fighters tried to advance to the Elite Eight. Who won yesterday? Who's going to win today? 713-780-3776. Killer Bees live from Rose Hill Beer Garden in Cypress on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.